We believe the long national nightmare will be over tonight.
The longest federal government shutdown in U.S. history is about to come to an end.
We will look at the details of the bill and at what comes next politically.
For Wednesday, November 12th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. Ahead, we'll hear from local groups scrambling to keep operating after the Trump administration cut hundreds of millions of dollars in public safety grants.
These cuts are significant and unprecedented.
And we'll look up in the sky.
At the Northern Lights, set to appear again tonight over most of the U.S.
And then even higher at the International Space Station orbiting Earth.
One, you're very focused on the task that you have to do. But then the little kid side of you goes, oh my gosh, these are incredible views.
Those stories after this news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Ryland Barton. After weeks of delay, Arizona Democrat Adelita Grijalva has been sworn in as the newest member of the House of Representatives. Her arrival comes more than 50 days after she won a special election to fill the seat last held by her late father, Congressman Raul Grijalva.
Over 800,000 Arizonans have been left without access to the basic services that every constituent deserves. This is an abuse of power. One individual should not be able to unilaterally obstruct the swearing in of a duly elected member of Congress for political reasons.
As one of her first acts in Congress, Grijalva signed a petition to force a vote to release of the files related to Jeffrey Epstein. President Trump is dismissing revelations that Epstein mentioned him in emails. The White House accuses Democrats of selectively leaking the emails. Epstein wrote in 2011 that Trump, quote, spent hours at his house with a girl who prosecutors say was a sex trafficking victim. In a separate message years later, Epstein said Trump, quote, knew about the girls. Trump denies any knowledge of Epstein's crimes. The House of Representatives is debating a measure to reopen the government. If passed, the package would need the signature of President Trump to officially end the longest shutdown in U.S. history. NPR's Sam Greenglass reports.
After 43 days, the federal government is on track to reopen for the first time since September 30th. The record-long shutdown has resulted in federal employees missing paychecks, severe staffing shortages at the nation's airports, and confusion as people go without food assistance benefits. The House is voting on a package passed Monday by the Senate, which would temporarily fund most of the government through January and some specific agencies through next September. The deal does not extend expiring health insurance subsidies, though Democrats extracted the promise of a Senate vote on a health care measure by mid-September. The House has not done any legislative business during the entire length of the shutdown. Sam Greenglass, NPR News, Washington.
The Food and Drug Administration is creating a new way for approving cutting-edge treatments for rare diseases, NPR's Rob Stein reports.
In a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine, two top FDA officials describe what they call a new, quote, plausible mechanism pathway for approving treatments. Instead of requiring complicated and expensive studies testing an experimental treatment on patients, the FDA says some therapies could be approved based on other criteria that could include evidence that the treatment can help patients by fixing the underlying cause of the disease, like a genetic defect. The approach is aimed at making it more practical to use cutting-edge technologies like gene editing to treat patients suffering from rare diseases. Rob Stein, NPR News.
U.S. stocks closed mixed today. You're listening to NPR News from Washington. Israel's president says the country must take action against what he's calling shocking and serious Jewish settler violence against Palestinians and Israeli soldiers in the occupied West Bank. Criticism of settler violence from top Israeli officials is usually muted. Yesterday, dozens of masked Israeli settlers attacked two Palestinian West Bank villages and clashed with Israeli soldiers. The Turkish government says 20 soldiers died in a military cargo plane crash near the border of Azerbaijan and Georgia yesterday. Duri Berskaren reports search teams are still looking for the bodies of two victims.
The Turkish Ministry of National Defense released the names of the 20 military personnel killed when their cargo plane crashed in Georgia's mountainous Kakheti region. It had departed from nearby Azerbaijan and was headed to northern Turkey. The dead include a father of three, a newlywed, and a soldier whose wife is expecting their first child. The 57-year-old aircraft was a C-130 Hercules, built by Lockheed Martin. It's a mainstay of air forces around the world, despite its age. The manufacturer says it will assist with the investigation into the cause of the crash. The crash is Turkey's deadliest military incident in 5.5 years. For NPR News, I'm Derry Buscarin.
Three paintings from public television legend Bob Ross have sold for over $600,000. The paintings are part of a collection of 30 works being sold to support public TV stations affected by federal funding cuts. A piece entitled Winter's Peace, painted during a 1993 episode of The Joy of Painting, fetched $318,000. This is NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Wallace Foundation, an independent, nonpartisan research foundation collaborating with grantees and partners in the arts, school leadership, and youth development. More at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR.
It is 4:06. Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. Support comes from the Timberlake Restaurant in Grand Rapids, featuring Martini Monday each week from 5 to 8. More information at TimberlakeLodgeHotel.com. Mostly clear tonight with lows in the mid-20s and sunny tomorrow with highs in the upper 40s to low 50s. Apparently, it's supposed to be a good night once again for the Northern Lights. We continue with All Things Considered on KAXE.
From NPR News, I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. The House is expected to approve legislation later tonight to end the longest government shutdown in U.S. history. House Speaker Mike Johnson says that he is confident it will pass.
We believe the long national nightmare will be over tonight.
Well, NPR congressional correspondent Deirdre Walsh joins us now from the Capitol. Hi, Deirdre.
Hey, Elsa.
All right, so after 43 days, Congress has a deal to reopen the government. What is in this deal exactly?
Well, this bill funds most federal agencies through the end of January. It also includes three spending bills that were negotiated between both parties, and those include a full year's funding for some agencies, like the Veterans Administration, money for food assistance programs. Mm-hmm. This also includes a provision to reverse the layoffs that the Trump administration put into place since the start of the shutdown. But one thing it does not include is anything to deal with the central issue that caused the shutdown, the demand from Democrats to extend healthcare subsidies that are expiring at the end of this year.
Right. And we know that most Senate Democrats did not like this deal because it did not address healthcare subsidies. So how are House Democrats feeling?
They're not happy about it either. I mean, many House Democrats coming out of a caucus meeting this morning pointed to results just last week of off-year elections. Democratic candidates won a pair of governor's races, also won some local elections. And they say voters backed the shutdown strategy and thought that Democrats had more leverage to force action on health care. California Democratic Congressman Ro Khanna just ripped the compromise.
I think the American people got a raw deal. 20 million Americans are going to see their premiums skyrocket. I don't think they like the fact that we didn't fight hard enough.
Well, healthcare subsidies, Deirdre, are expiring at the end of December. So is Congress going to do anything before then?
It's not a lot of time. I mean, Senate Majority Leader John Thune agreed to hold a vote by mid-December on legislation that Democrats are working on. But that's just a couple of weeks before those tax credits expire. There are some Senate Republicans who want to address the issue, but there's no agreement on any details, how long the subsidies would be extended, if they're going to cap them by income level. The Senate Democrats who negotiated this deal say President Trump is really under pressure to engage. They say, you know, more people in red states that backed Trump rely on these subsidies than people in blue states.
Okay, but that's the Senate side. What about the House side?
I mean, House Speaker Mike Johnson hasn't committed to any health care vote in the House, even if the Senate passes something. You know, Democrats believe that rising premiums that people are expected to see very soon get at the heart of cost of living concerns that were front and center in those elections last week. They believe this is something that will resonate in the 2026 midterms. We saw House Democratic Leader Hakeem Jeffries hold a rally on the east front of the Capitol earlier today. He vowed to make this an issue.
House Democrats will continue the fight to address the Republican health care crisis, and House Democrats will fight to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits. This fight is not over. We're just getting started.
Okay, that fight isn't over, but assuming the president signs this bill quickly, do you have any idea how long it might take for government services to resume and for workers to see their paychecks again?
Well, under the law, federal workers are entitled to back pay, and the guidance is that they should return to work as soon as possible when the bill is signed, and they'll get paid as soon as possible. One thing that we may see as a little bit of a leftover from the shutdown is airport delays due to staffing shortages. The Secretary of Transportation says they're going to evaluate the restrictions when they look at staffing levels getting back to normal.
That is NPR's Deirdre Walsh. Thank you, Deirdre.
Thanks, Elsa.
6 months after the Trump administration cut hundreds of millions of dollars in public safety grants, many recipients are scrambling to stay afloat. The cuts target everything from gun violence prevention to youth mentoring programs. NPR's Meg Anderson reports.
At Washington Tech Senior High School in St. Paul, Minnesota, Principal Elias Ogus was shocked when a grant-funded position at his school suddenly got cut last spring.
This was named as the Stop the Violence Grant, and who would want to cut Stop the Violence Grant?
He says the woman he hired was doing great work resolving conflicts between students. He was determined to save her job.
What we did was we committed $50,000 from the school budget that was designated for our instructional supplies.
Foregoing school supplies to keep a position. He found other ways to make up the gap too. Some money from the school district, donations from the community, but
we don't have this money to go for a second year.
He is not the only one grappling with that uncertainty. In April, the Justice Department canceled more than $800 million in federal grant money going to hundreds of organizations around the country.
These cuts are significant and unprecedented.
Amy Solomon is the former head of the DOJ's Office of Justice Programs. That's the office that made these cuts.
When an administration gives a grant to an organization, that is a promise for the full amount. And so organizations plan, they budget, they hire.
Instead, the DOJ canceled these grants in the middle of their time frame. The cuts affected school violence initiatives like the one in St. Paul, also training for police officers, resources for domestic violence victims, hate crime prevention. Almost all of the cuts were to nonprofits. Solomon says that reveals how the Trump DOJ thinks about public safety.
The kind of old school thinking is that it's only police that can keep communities safe. And what we're seeing out in the field more and more is that community-based organizations work as a complement to law enforcement.
NPR spoke with 10 organizations that experienced cuts. A couple had their grants reactivated, but most said they have had to lay off employees, dip into reserve funds, or shrink the services they offer.
We got hit pretty hard.
Everett Penn co-founded TAPS in Houston, which connects law enforcement and young people through mentoring. They've had to cut staff. Penn knows organizations are not entitled to grants, but he says this is how the system has worked for years.
It's the government sector that funds things that often are not funded in the private sector because they're necessary for us to keep our society functioning.
Dwight Robeson is with ROCA, which does community violence intervention in multiple states.
We didn't see this coming, to be candid.
He says they've had to cut about 50 positions. Now they're looking for other funding streams. He says ROCA will get through this, but when it comes to other groups,
I'm sure there are funders that are looking at organizations and saying, gosh, they're doing good work, but it's unclear whether they're going to be there in 2, 3, 4, 5 years.
Most of the organizations NPR spoke with said the DOJ has not reimbursed them for money they already spent. And the ones that appealed the cut said they haven't heard back either. In a statement, the Justice Department told NPR the ongoing government shutdown is hindering its ability to consider appeals or reimburse organizations. The department canceled these grants, however, 5 months before the shutdown began. Meg Anderson, NPR News.
When we think of the Northern Lights, we do not usually think about them in Tennessee. But on Tuesday night, the aurora borealis was visible in Tennessee, as well as Missouri, New Mexico, and other states. This is all due to geomagnetic storm activity. More of that activity is predicted tonight, and the aurora may be visible as far south as Alabama. If you want to take some good photos of this rare event, St. Louis Public Radio's visuals editor, Brian Munoz, is here with some tips. Hi, Brian.
Hey, Scott.
Did you have any luck last night?
I think the best way to think about that is kind of. I had this whole elaborate plan to photograph the Gateway Arch National Park and the St. Louis skyline, but honestly, I struck out on that one. I went to my big lookout point, and it was just simply too bright. So I drove home, looked out the window, and saw the lights across the street and said, you know what? I'm just going to make a photo of this in my neighborhood and ended up with something usable. But, you know, like with anything, you go out there, you try some different things, and if they don't work out, you pivot.
I'm always hesitant to ask a legitimate photographer about taking pictures with phones because that's just how so many people take pictures these days, right? If you want to get a good picture of the aurora borealis with your iPhone, can you do that? Like, well, what are your tips for an amateur?
You absolutely can. You do not need this big fancy camera kit to be able to photograph this celestial spectacle. I recommend that you turn on your long exposure mode or your night mode, that wherever you go, you have a nice clear shot with ideally something in the foreground to give you that perspective, and turn off your flash. You don't need a flash when you're doing this long exposure work. And make sure you're standing straight up with your arms tightly against your body and you frame your image and click the shutter. Any little shake is going to make your image blurry. It's not going to give you the best result that you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
So really, it's slowing down, think about what you're doing, and then execute the image.
Is any of this doable if you live in a big city with light pollution? Or is that just a lost cause? Like, how do you get around that?
So it can be hit and miss. So my experience, I definitely was a little bit of a lost cause there at first. But really just getting away from the lights as much as you can. You know, taking an extra 30 minutes to drive out to the country if you're able to. Or just finding a spot where there aren't bright lights flashing directly at you. And that has been pretty helpful.
What are some common mistakes that people make, whether it's the northern lights or the moon or taking pictures of the stars? What are some basic mistakes people make when they're trying to take pictures of the night sky?
Wipe your camera lens. Please, 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 please. So many times I
blanket advice.
right. So many times I see people have blurry pictures or smudgy pictures, and it's like, hey, take that soft microfiber cloth and just clean the back of your phone or the back of your lens. Also, not willing to adjust your settings. If you try something and it doesn't work, you know, try something different. You know, don't just keep on doing the same thing and think something spectacular is going to come of that.
This is all good life advice in addition to photography, I think.
Yeah, you know, I'll take it.
That is St. Louis Public Radio's visuals editor, Brian Munoz. Thanks so much and good luck tonight.
Thanks.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thanks for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. It is 4:18. In just a few moments, our daily dose of phenology. John Latimer looks back at his nature notes for this date. The Bemidji area's 100-plus Women Who Care event is tomorrow at South Shore Hotel on Lake Bemidji. Social hour starts at 5. The event will run from 6 to 7. Let us know what's going on in your community. Send us an email, psa@kaxe.org.
On today's date, November 12th in the year 2009, a buddy of mine and I are out doing a little duck hunting, and as you might expect, there are a few ducks around. But those that remain here include a feisty, speedy, diminutive member of the duck family, the bufflehead. The bufflehead is a remarkable duck. The male is mostly white, has a little bit of black on it here and there, but largely white when you see it in its breeding plumage. The female is more gray. Both have large heads with large patches of white feathers on the backs of the heads. They are cavity nesters. In their breeding areas, they nest in small flocks, and they can aggregate into very large flocks. They spend a lot of time diving and eating clams and other crustaceans, insect larvae, whatever they can find at the bottom of a lake. And they then start their way south sort of later than other ducks. They're well past the end of the mallards and the scaup and others that would be up in front of them. And when they fly, the wind over their wings can make a sharply whistling sound, and so they're sometimes known as whistlers. Typically, when I see the whistlers, I know that the duck hunting season is coming to an end.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BritBox, committed to helping viewers to see it differently with British TV, with new original series like Code of Silence, about a deaf woman recruited as a lip reader in a high-stakes police investigation, streaming at BritBox.com. From Capital One, offering their premium travel card Venture X. What's in your wallet? Terms apply. Details at CapitalOne.com. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Elsa Chang.
And I'm Scott Detrow. The International Space Station is turning 25 this month. 25 years of people from all over the world living together and working together in space. At the same time, it is starting to wrap up its mission in space. The space station is set to be decommissioned in 2030. A new PBS documentary tells the story of what it took to build the station and some of the dangerous experiences astronauts had to endure on board. We're going to talk about that now with executive producer Tom Adams, as well as astronaut Wendy Lawrence. Welcome, both of you.
Thank you.
Hello.
Tom, I want to start with you because it's interesting. I feel like a lot of people interact with the space station by watching the various live streams of it, you know, the view from the space station. And it can be a very peaceful experience to watch that. But the reality that you really lean into in this documentary is that it's not a particularly peaceful place to live and work. It is incredibly dangerous to be orbiting the Earth, and there's constantly one problem or another with no safety net.
I think that's the point. I mean, it looks serene up there. It looks like a place you would love to spend time, and I'm sure the astronauts do. But as one of our contributors says, everything up there is trying to kill you. And if that's your starting point, then to have created this extraordinary laboratory that is circling the Earth to conduct the most extraordinary science in, it's a story and a half. I mean, it's incredible that structure was built in those kind of conditions.
Wendy, how often did you actively think about it that way? That everything up there is trying to kill us. I mean, is that something you just kind of work to problem solve, or is that in the back of your head as you hear a creak or a groan or whatever on the space station day to day?
I didn't have an opportunity to do a long-duration mission. My mission on the shuttle was for a short period, about 8 days. And honestly, you're so busy day in and day out trying to accomplish everything that you've been scheduled to do that day that there's not a lot of time to reflect. But I do have to say that as we were conducting our spacewalks, I was inside flying the International Space Station robotic arm. It was a little disconcerting to hear my fellow astronauts out in their suits clunking their boots along on the outside of the NASA laboratory module. That was not a noise I expected to hear. And it does make you pause and think about the fact that, yes, you are in a very unforgiving environment. And you always have to respect the laws of physics and recognize that the laws of physics will always win. So from an engineering perspective, you have to acknowledge that and then come up with a design that can be robust enough to handle that very extreme environment.
I want to talk about one moment in part one of the documentary that Wendy, you played a role in, a pretty tense situation where the space shuttle Discovery had to be inspected because there were concerns that the heat shield had been damaged, and that was top of mind to everybody, because this was the first mission after the Columbia disaster, and safety was paramount First, Tom, I want to talk to you. Why did you focus in on that? There's 25 years of different missions to focus on. Why was this one of the moments that you really wanted to zoom in on and fully understand?
I think there are these moments that required calm thinking and scientific approaches that in a way exemplified what the people involved in the space missions were doing. They didn't have everything to hand. They were isolated. They were up in space. Yes, they had communications to Earth and they had people on the ground helping them think through, but they had to make the best with what they had. And it seemed like this event was a perfect example of that, as Wendy says, a part of the space shuttle that wasn't meant to be looked at had to be looked at, and by doing a 360, but also by getting someone on a robotic arm and putting them where someone had never been before, just showed what was possible with, as I say, calm thinking, but having a job to do and needing to do it well.
Wendy, what do you remember about that experience? You're guiding this arm, trying to get a fellow astronaut basically under, like changing the oil almost of a space shuttle, except it's a space shuttle and you're in space.
You know, you have kind of a split personality at that moment. One, you're very focused on the task that you have to do, which in my case was fly Steve Robinson very close to the thermal protection system tiles on the underside of the orbiter, so we could pull out two things that we called gap fillers. But then kind of the little kid side of you goes, oh my gosh, these are incredible views. We've never seen imagery like this before. Nobody's ever been here before. And we're getting to do this. This is so cool. But then you're very focused as, okay, Steve, I'll take you 6 inches to the right. Okay, motion starting, motion stopped. So that dual personality to me was always very interesting. But to Tom's point, this really is a great tribute to the team on the ground that supports a crew during their mission. They're the people that put together the plan that made it very easy for the crew to carry out this activity. So to me, they're the true heroes of the story. You know, unsung, unfortunately, but really the true heroes behind this.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot to talk about when it comes to the International Space Station. There's the technological marvels, and I think there's also, like, the global political marvel of it. I interviewed former NASA Administrator Bill Nelson a couple years ago, and he made the point that, you know, U.S.-Russia relations are at their lowest point they've been since the Cold War. And he said the U.S. and Russia never stopped working together at the space station. I mean, Wendy, what was your point of view on that collaboration and how it worked moment to moment in a space station, and just how remarkable that is and was?
Well, I have to back up. Back in the mid-90s, we had our doubts about whether or not we could make this partnership be successful. But it was really the astronauts and cosmonauts, many of whom served in the militaries for their countries, who had actually trained to go to war against one another. We realized that we had the same job. We didn't speak the same language, but we had a common background, and we used that as kind of the glue to hold the program together and the foundation upon which to build the program. And I say this often, and I'm very sincere in these comments. I think historians will look at the International Space Station program and say, yeah, some really fascinating science was being conducted on board. The most significant contribution was that when we humans choose to do this, we truly can take those proverbial swords and beat them into plowshares. We can do some remarkable things together for all of mankind, for the benefit of humankind.
That was astronaut Wendy Lawrence, as well as Tom Adams, the executive producer of the new PBS documentary, Operation Space Station. Thanks to you both.
Thank you, Scott.
Thank you.
This is NPR News.
It is 4:29. Thanks for listening to People Powered KAXC and All Things Considered. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a few moments, national Native news, and 1 hour from now, it's the Up North Report, local news from our region. Support comes from Boreal Brushworks Painting in Bemidji, providing full-service interior painting in residential and commercial locations in northern Minnesota since 2009. More information at borealbrushworkspainting.com. And we thank ICTV. Stay tuned, stay connected with ICTV. Learn more at watchictv.org. Mostly clear tonight with lows in the mid-20s. There is a good forecast for the Northern Lights once again tonight. Weather for tomorrow, sunny with highs in the upper 40s to low 50s with light and variable wind. Looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny and warmer, highs near 55. Coming up at 7 o'clock tonight, Dave Murphy is your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. Current rules defining how the Colorado River is to be shared by 40 million residents in the West will soon expire. The seven basin states had until Tuesday to negotiate those new guidelines. As KJZZ's Gabriel Pietrazio reports, no deal was struck.
States still cannot come to terms, leaving tribes lost in the shuffle. Daniel Cordalis is Navajo and runs the Native American Rights Fund's Tribal Water Institute. He believes the Bureau of Reclamation's deadline is arbitrary.
If it means anything, maybe the federal government's going to step in and start throwing some weight around.
When no reclamation nominee has been tapped to replace Trump's old pick, Ted Cook. Beyond the bickering upper and lower basin states, there's 30 federally recognized tribes stuck in the middle of a decades-old debate on how best to divvy the water while keeping the ever-dwindling river flowing.
They have to try to come up with ideas that are doable and that will benefit the entire system, not just tribes. And I hope that none of that is compromised by this deadline coming and going.
For National Native News, I'm Gabriel Pietrazio.
Alaska Federation of Natives President Ben Mallah and about 100 other tribal leaders were in Washington, D.C. last week and had a brief visit with Vice President J.D. Vance on Friday. Mallah said it was a good step forward to be invited and is looking forward to more engagement next year. Vance gave a brief presentation on the potential for economic development in Indian country, including manufacturing. Principal Chief of the Cherokee Nation, Chuck Hoskin Jr., said it was good to hear the vice president focus on things that could be done in Indian country. Months before a storm devastated parts of western Alaska, a federal agency canceled a grant that would have helped protect one of the communities from flooding. Ayolna Niden with the Alaska Desk has more on what that money could have done for the village of Kipnuk and what lies ahead for the community.
Raina Paul is the environmental director for the village of Kipnuk. Her house was one of many that was swept upriver during the historic storm last month.
We were so not ready. We were so not prepared.
Paul says the community now needs time to heal and rebuild. The remnants of Typhoon Halon devastated about a dozen villages. Months before the storm, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency canceled a $20 million grant that would have helped Kipnuk protect infrastructure from flooding. Paul says Kipnuk has been losing more than 10 feet of riverbank each year.
We're facing erosion. The sea level is rising. The permafrost is melting.
Paul spent months applying for funding through the EPA's Community Change Grants Program. But the Trump administration terminated the program in May in a broader effort to roll back environmental justice funding. The decision is at the heart of the lawsuit that Kipnuk signed on to in August. The court denied a motion to block the program's termination. The plaintiffs appealed that decision. Cheryl Musgrove is with the Alaska Institute for Justice.
This was a chance for the federal government to finally show that they cared and that they were willing to invest in this small community in remote Alaska.
EPA Press Secretary Bridget Hirsch said that the funding would not have prevented destruction in the community. Hirsch said that, quote, while partisans on the left would apparently prefer to have seen those precious tax dollars washed away, EPA now has the resources available to ensure the money is spent appropriately and wisely. End quote. Musgrove says the first year of the grant was meant for planning, and the construction would have not begun by the time of the storm. She says that the first phase would have also included hazardous waste removal.
Now that's in the river in the Bering Sea.
Musgrove says she hopes that the devastation of the storm highlights the needs of the villages like Kipnuk and helps them mobilize resources for finding long-term solutions. In Anchorage, I am Alona Niden.
And I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
National Native News is produced by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with funding by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
From comics to games to film and TV, Indigipop X is Native American popular culture. Everyone is welcome this weekend at Duke University in Durham, North Carolina. Info at indigipopx.com who support this show.
Need help identifying community priorities? Kaufman & Associates' approach to evaluation is rooted in Indigenous knowledge, honoring tribal history, and sovereignty. More at kaufmaninc.com. KAUFFMANINC.com.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Network.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Charles Schwab, offering investors choices like full-service wealth management, advice, investing, and trading on Thinkorswim. Learn more at schwab.com. From your part-time controller, specializing in nonprofit accounting and committed to supporting nonprofits with financial management services such as budgeting and forecasting, yptc.com/NPR. And from the sustaining members of this NPR station.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow in Washington.
And I'm Elsa Chang in Culver City, California. Members of the House Oversight Committee have released dueling sets of documents related to the late Jeffrey Epstein. Democrats are highlighting three email threads that refer to President Trump. Meanwhile, Republicans have released more than 20,000 pages that they say provide more context. NPR's Stephen Fowler has been reading through all of the documents and joins us now with an update. Hi, Stephen.
Hey there.
Hey, okay, so let's start with the files that the Democrats are highlighting about President Trump. What do they say exactly?
Well, those three email chains that Democrats initially released, there's also another dozen or so pages they've highlighted online. Okay. They include the disgraced financier Epstein discussing Trump. In 2011, Epstein emailed Ghislaine Maxwell, his associate who has been convicted on trafficking charges, called Trump the, quote, dog that hasn't barked, and says Trump spent hours at his house with one of the alleged sex trafficking victims. There's a 2015 thread with author Michael Wolff that saw Wolff suggest Epstein could get, quote, valuable PR and political currency if Trump denied being on Epstein's plane or at his house. And a 2019 exchange that saw Epstein say that, quote, of course Trump knew about the girls as he asked Ghislaine to stop. That email does not elaborate further.
Wait, how has President Trump responded to these specific messages that mention him by name?
On his Truth Social account, he once again called questions around Epstein a hoax and said that, quote, only a very bad or stupid Republican would fall into that trap. Here's what White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said today in a press briefing.
These emails prove absolutely nothing other than the fact that President Trump did nothing wrong. And what President Trump has always said is that he was from Palm Beach and so was Jeffrey Epstein. Jeffrey Epstein was a member at Mar-a-Lago until President Trump kicked him out because Jeffrey Epstein was a pedophile and he was a creep.
Okay, well, as we said, the Republican majority on the Oversight Committee did release a full set of more than 20,000 pages of files today. Have they pointed to anything in those documents that support the White House's statement there?
Well, nothing specific, but a few of us at NPR have spent the day combing through these files that were released. We haven't made it through every single page, but here's a little bit of what we've seen. There's court records from Epstein's sex trafficking and prostitution cases, 400 pages of attorney Alan Dershowitz's autobiography, financial market reports related to Epstein's career, emails with powerful people in politics and finance and academia, and actually a good deal more about Donald Trump.
Oh, really? Like what?
Well, Trump has said before that he and Epstein had this falling out a few decades ago over Epstein hiring away girls from Mar-a-Lago. Leavitt alluded to that rift a little bit in her comments we heard. And these email threads show Epstein spent a lot of time in 2016, 17, and 18 talking about Trump and his dislike of the president. For example, I found one 2017 message where Epstein wrote to former Treasury Secretary Lawrence Summers that, quote, I have met some very bad people, none as bad as Trump, and, quote, not one decent cell in his body.
Huh. Okay, well, this latest Epstein files revelation comes as the House has returned, of course. And I understand that they now have enough votes to advance what's called a discharge petition to seek the release of even more Epstein files, right? When is that vote happening?
Well, after nearly 2 months of delay, Democratic Representative Adelita Grijalva was sworn in this afternoon. She's the 218th vote on this bipartisan petition seeking to get the Justice Department to release more about Epstein. That would get to the floor next week, but it's also important to note the petition would not necessarily pass in the Senate or be signed by President Trump. Trump's faced ongoing political fallout from his efforts to change the subject and downplay the Epstein files after campaigning on uncovering the truth.
That is NPR's Stephen Fowler. Thank you, Stephen.
Thank you.
For groups working to bridge the digital divide, the Trump administration's decision not to release Digital Equity Act grant funds has meant disruption or cancellation of programs that try to help people get and stay online. The $2.75 billion program was meant to teach people how to do everything from using a healthcare portal to finding a job. But President Trump labeled the program racist and ended it. Nonprofits soon learned the grants that they had won would not be coming. The Texas Standard's Shelley Brisbane has more.
So this page is what we call the home page. This is where you can sort of navigate to anything you need to do on GroupMe. The main thing we can see is that over here we have all the group chats we're a part of.
Joseph Ariella is leading 20 seniors at the Asian American Resource Center in Austin, Texas, through a class on messaging. Arciela Adams has a question.
What if you wanted to lead some of these messages?
Adams, who's 76, is new to the online world. She says she wants to protect herself and avoid making mistakes with her smartphone. This intermediate internet class is just the sort of training the Digital Equity Act was designed to offer to seniors, veterans, and others with limited online skills. Even in Central Texas, where high tech is big business, service agencies had counted on the Digital Equity Act to reach more people.
A lot of the resources in Austin are not available outside of Austin areas, so we had to limit what we had planned on providing.
Jamie Castleberry is director of grants at Goodwill Central Texas, which provides job training in 15 counties. The agency planned to spend $650,000 to expand digital training into rural areas.
We saw gaps in how people are able to access the internet. So these community partners are really connected to how the people they serve in the populations struggle to get online and stay online.
Sarah Nichols is with the Land of Sky Regional Council, a coalition of governments in Western North Carolina. The agency won a $7.7 million Digital Equity Act grant to expand training to underserved people in the region. Last fall, Hurricane Helene devastated the region, and residents needed internet access more than ever.
So we spent a lot of the money that we had putting those resources out back in the fall. Then we were really excited when we found out we were going to get this grant because it would help us continue to get our folks back online.
But the money never came. The Digital Equity Act promised $1.4 billion for state programs and $1.25 billion for nonprofits and collaborating groups. The act's mention of racial minorities got the White House's attention, even though none of the approved grants focused on specific racial groups, nor did they exclude others. And the law's name.
So basically, the administration, they were going through any program, any law that had anything to do with equity and attacking it.
Drew Garner is director of policy engagement at the Benton Institute for Broadband and Society, an advocacy group working to expand internet access. The White House did not respond to a request for a comment on its decision not to fund approved grants. The National Digital Inclusion Alliance filed suit against the Trump administration in October, challenging termination of its $25.7 million grant. And a coalition of 20-plus states sued the administration in June over funds they had been promised. These lawsuits are ongoing. For NPR News, I'm Shelley Brisbane in Austin.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Thank you for listening to KAXE and All Things Considered. It is 4:44. I'm Jennifer Barr. In just a moment, North Star Stories, produced by Ampers, stories from throughout Minnesota. Programming is supported in part by the Bush Foundation, proud to partner with the Good Relatives Collaborative to announce the 2025 Bush Prize Native Nations honorees, the Minneapolis Indian Center, Mokoche Agriculture Development, and Turtle Mountain Impact. More online at goodrelativescollaborative.org. If you are at least 70 and a half years old, supporting KAXE's future is easy. You can ask your financial advisor to set up charitable IRA distributions to benefit KAXE. If you have questions, call Chris 218-326-1234. Mostly clear tonight with lows in the mid-20s. And for tomorrow, sunny with highs in the upper 40s to low 50s. And looking ahead to Friday, mostly sunny and warmer, highs near 55.
You are listening to North Star Stories, voices from where we live, a daily newscast about what it means to live in Minnesota.
In today's stories, the state aims to keep funding for healthcare. Then, how can a simple battery be a major fire hazard? And an organic conference returns to central Minnesota. I'm Chantel Sings. Minnesota's Attorney General joined 21 attorneys general from other states in supporting Planned Parenthood's lawsuit against the Trump administration's efforts to block federal Medicaid funding. The lawsuit alleges that the so-called defund provision would cut access to essential healthcare services like cancer screenings and birth control. The coalition's brief urges the First Circuit Court of Appeals to uphold a lower court ruling that blocked the funding ban. Next, lithium-ion batteries power everything from phones to e-bikes, but they can also pose serious fire risks if handled incorrectly. Reporter Faya Adam tells us how to prevent these fires.
Recently, the life of the Freeman family was changed completely. Their home in Woodbury, east of St. Paul, caught on fire. The cause? A lithium-ion battery explosion.
We were still in bed. It was about 8 o'clock in the morning. We hadn't even woken up yet.
Patty Freeman says the fire was caused by human error after her son tried to charge the battery.
Kind of guessed right away that it was a lithium battery because of where the fire started in the basement. Within 20 minutes of him plugging in the battery, it exploded.
Lithium-ion batteries, a type of rechargeable battery characterized by higher energy efficiency and a longer cycle life than other types of rechargeable batteries, are in many of today's devices, like cell phones, laptops, lawn tools, and even children's toys. Yet, many people don't know about the battery's hidden risk.
We see that lithium-ion batteries could be charged incorrectly. They maybe have physical damage to them.
Daniel Cryer is a state fire marshal. He says using non-certified chargers and knockoff batteries increases the risk of lithium-ion batteries exploding or catching on fire.
With modern conveniences, it can be easy to buy the cheap product or the easiest to grab product off the shelf or at the online store. Those don't necessarily always come with the same testing and safety features that the original manufacturer provides.
All fires give off toxic smoke, but lithium-ion battery fires are different. The metals and plastics inside can release even more dangerous chemicals, such as cyanide, into the air. To help prevent these kinds of fires, there are a few simple safety steps you can take. Buy only products with a safety mark from a nationally recognized testing lab, which ensures they meet safety standards. Use only chargers approved by the manufacturer for that specific device. Avoid charging items when you're not home, and place devices on a flat surface away from anything flammable. Store batteries in a cool, dry place away from direct sunlight.
If we can change those and influence those behaviors to where people are purchasing a product that's going to keep it safe, a charger that's safe, a cord that's been rated for that battery, that will definitely prevent and lower a lot of risk from more of these batteries being on the market.
For more fire prevention tips, visit your local fire department's website or dps.mn.gov. For For North Star Stories, I'm Bai Adam.
You are listening to North Star Stories. The Minnesota Organic Conference is returning to St. Cloud next year. Hosted by the Department of Agriculture, the event will feature more than 30 breakout sessions and an 80-booth trade show focused on organic farming and research. The keynote speaker will share strategies for improving soil health and farm resilience, and a new farmer-led panel will explore the future of organic agriculture. Registration is now open for participants. For details, visit the Minnesota Organic Conference website.
North Star Stories is produced by Ambers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, with support from the McKnight Foundation and the State of Minnesota, online at ambers.org.
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Scott Detrow.
And I'm Elsa Chang. In recent years, cups of vibrant green matcha lattes have become almost as recognizable as the ubiquitous coffee-based latte. Matcha is made with ground green tea leaves whisked into hot water. The drink is traditional in Japan, where matcha is the central element for hours-long tea ceremonies. And its surging global popularity could be an opportunity for Japanese growers. But as our next guest warns, they've got to act fast to protect their product. David Fickling is a Bloomberg opinion columnist and joins us now to talk about his idea. Welcome.
Hey there, how are you?
Good. Okay, I know that we reached you in Australia where it's quite early at the moment. I have to ask you, are you having a matcha right now as we're talking, or something stronger to wake you up?
I'll need something a little bit stronger shortly, but actually I'm acting purely on adrenaline at the moment.
Oh my goodness. Okay, so I feel like I see matcha everywhere, but have we quantified just how popular it is globally at this point?
At the moment, it's a huge market and it has been booming. The latest figure I've seen has said this is a $4.53 billion market. But I think it's worth looking relative to tea as a whole. It is absolutely a tiny niche product. And a crucial thing with this is that Japan, they're actually struggling with the scale of demand that we're seeing. But of course, you know, 15 years ago, you would never really see a cup of matcha anywhere outside a tea ceremony. Now, it's everywhere. I ordered McDonald's last week and there was a matcha latte was offered to me free in addition to the meal.
Oh, so, I didn't know McDonald's was on this too.
In Australia, McDonald's is offering matcha lattes. Oh. Clearly, there in the US, everything is full of matcha. And those farms in Japan just can't keep up.
Well, I was going to ask you, because China, I know, has been trying to get in on the action. And China grows a lot of lovely tasting teas. But does matcha from China taste the same to a seasoned matcha drinker? What do you think?
I don't think it does. I'm not a connoisseur, I have to say, of tea. But according to a government report by the Chinese government a few years ago, China already produces more matcha than Japan. To be clear, matcha is simply it's powdered shade grown tea. So it's just a way of growing tea.
Right. Wait, hold on. Can you just for me put into words, I know this might be a little bit challenging, but put into words what really good matcha is supposed to taste like? We do this with wine all the time. We talk about the notes. So tell me about the notes of really fine matcha, please.
People will often talk about umami, which is another of these Japanese words. It describes the flavor of soy sauce and you know, grilled meat. It's those sort of rich, savory flavors.
Okay. And the really good matcha, as you say, is generally from Japan. And this is where your big idea comes in. You say essentially Japan should treat matcha like France treats champagne. How would that work exactly?
Yeah, well, in Europe for more than a century now, they've had this tradition of what they call geographic indications. This is why you can't call champagne unless your wine is grown in the Champagne region of France. And they enforce that through trade agreements around the world.
Wait, but the problem with the name matcha is it doesn't reflect a region, a location. It literally means, as you said, ground tea. So how do you make matcha be associated with a region if it actually isn't a regional word?
That is a problem. And like we've seen, like cheddar cheese is an example of this. I'm from the UK originally. Cheddar cheese does not have one of these geographic name protections because cheddaring describes just a way of making cheese. However, matcha is associated within Japan with lots of very specific regions. There's a Nishio matcha is one region, Uji matcha, Fukuoka matcha. If you are a matcha connoisseur, these regions mean a lot to you, and these could be protected.
Wow. So you're kind of suggesting imitating something that France does, like protect Bordeaux or Burgundy, you know, these kinds of wines that can trade on their reputations regionally.
Exactly. Because matcha it's a global trade now. There is no way that Japanese growers are just going to be able to compete with the scale of the Chinese trade.
So do you think your idea will have any traction in Japan? Have you tried to shop it over there?
Well, this region, Nishio Matcha, they had this geographic protection a few years ago, and they petitioned to be removed from the register because they said Japanese drinkers are not prepared to pay for the labor-intensive methods that are required to maintain this geographical indication. And so they said, let's just get taken off the register and we can sell our product cheaper. The thing is, they can't get as cheap as the Chinese producers can get. So I think they need to show a bit of imagination. If champagne had the same attitude 100 years ago, champagne would be a very low-end product. We wouldn't be spending, you know, $100 a bottle, $200 a bottle for champagne.
I'm not saying that's a good thing, though.
It is if you're a grower.
David Fickling is an opinion columnist for Bloomberg. His piece is called The Matcha Craze Needs More Champagne. Thank you so much, David.
Thank you.
Last night, Jimmy Kimmel started his late-night show with a 20-minute monologue that memorialized the show's bandleader, who died earlier this week. Clito Escobedo III was 59 years old. He had performed with Jimmy Kimmel Live since the show started, and as NPR's Netta Ulubi reports, he had been a friend of Kimmel's since childhood.
Jimmy Kimmel fought tears throughout much of his monologue.
There was a boy who lived on my block.
When Kimmel was 9 years old, his family moved to Las Vegas. Kimmel befriended the slightly older, much cooler kid across the street. Clito Escobedo was the son of a professional saxophonist who grew up to be a widely respected saxophonist and singer himself. This is from Escobedo's 1995 solo album called Clito. Escobedo started gigging in bar bands while he was a college student. He toured with superstars such as Paula Abdul and Mark Antony before Kimmel's show started in 2003, as the late-night host remembered in his monologue.
I wanted Clito to lead my band. We grew up watching Dave and Paul, and the idea that anyone other than him would lead the band was terrifying. It had to be him.
Kimmel said the band also included Clito Escobedo's father. The two, he said, were so proud to be the only father and son that they knew of, playing together every night on television.
I mean, everyone loves Clito. He's everyone here at the show.
Kimmel did not disclose a cause of death, but he thanked staff at the UCLA Medical Center for taking, he said, incredibly good care of Clito Escobedo. And he closed his monologue by saying,
cherish your friends. We're not here forever.
Netta Ulubi, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from Arm, committed to delivering innovative advanced computing designed to enable worldwide companies to unleash the capabilities and experiences of AI. The future of AI is built on Arm, arm.com. From Progressive Insurance, with its Name Your Price tool, a way to see coverage options based on a driver's budget. Learn more at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. And from The Economist, In a world of rapid change, The Economist seeks to cut through the noise to offer insight into what matters now and what's coming next. Daily global reporting, podcasts, and videos at economist.com/NPR.
It's a minute before 5 o'clock. Thank you for listening to 91.7 KAXC Grand Rapids, 90.5 KBXC Bagley, Bemidji, 89.9 Brainerd, and on your smart speaker. We are people-powered radio in northern Minnesota. You can join us at KAXC.org. Lots of local news stories and conversations for you there, and click the donate button to show your support. I'm Jennifer Barr. Stay tuned for another hour of All Things Considered, including the Up North Report, local news from our region. 6 o'clock, as it happens, news from a Canadian perspective. And at 7, Dave Murphy, your volunteer host for On the River. He'll bring you a great mix of music. Clear skies tonight. Good chance for northern lights once again. Lows in the mid-20s. Sunny tomorrow with highs in the